Chapter 32. Summoned in Haste. To Egwene, Rand's visit to Cairhien seemed like one of those Grand Illuminator's fireworks displays she had heard of but never seen, exploding all through the city. The echoes seemed to reverberate without end. She did not go near the palace again, of course, but wise ones that went every day to search for traps laid with Sidar told her what went on. Nobles stared at one another with slitted eyes, Tyran and Cairhienin alike. Berylaine seemed to have gone into hiding, refusing to see anyone she did not have to. Ruark apparently took her to task for neglecting her duties with small effect. He appeared to be the only one unaffected in the whole palace. Even the servants jumped if you looked at them, though that might just have been having the wise ones themselves poking into every corner. In the tents, things were no better, among the wise ones anyway. The rest of the Aiel were like Ruark, calm and solid. Their attitude made the wise ones' moodiness even more tense by comparison, not that it needed any. Amis and Cerulea came back from meeting Rand all but hissing. They did not say why, not where Egwene could hear, but the feeling spread through the wise ones as fast as thought, until every one of them stalked about like a bristling cat, ready to claw anything that moved. Their apprentices stepped lightly and spoke softly, but still were scolded for what would have passed without notice before, and punished for what would have brought only a scolding. Shido wise ones appearing in the camp did not help. At least Therava and Emerys were wise ones. The third was Savannah herself, striding around self-importantly with her blouse unlaced enough to rival Berylaine, no matter how the dust blew. Therava and Emerys said Savannah was a wise one, and though Cerulea grumbled, there was no choice but to accept her as one. Egwene was sure they were spying, but Amis merely looked at her when she suggested it. Protected by custom, they had a free run of the tents, welcomed by all the wise ones, even Cerulea, as if close friends or first sisters. Still, their presence honed the edge of everyone's mood, especially Egwene's. That smirking cat Savannah knew who she was, and took no pains to hide her delight in sending the short apprentice girl to fetch a cup of water or the like at any opportunity. Savannah looked at her, too, a studying sort of gaze. It made Egwene think of someone studying a chicken, thinking how to cook it after they stole it. Worse than that, the wise ones would not tell her what they talked about. It was wise ones' business, and none of apprentices. For whatever reason the Shido were there, the mood among the other wise ones certainly interested them. More than once Egwene saw Savannah, when she thought herself unobserved, smile as she watched Amis or Malinda or Cosane stalk by, talking to herself and needlessly adjusting her shawl. No one listened to Egwene, of course. Too many comments about the Shido women finally earned her most of a day spent digging a hole deep enough to stand in without being seen. And when she climbed out, all sweat and filth, to begin filling it in, Savannah was watching. 2 days after Rand left, Aeron and some other wise ones talked three maidens into sneaking over the wall of Arillin's palace in the night to see what they could scout out, and that made everything worse. The three avoided Gawain's guards, if with more difficulty than they expected, but the Aes Sedai were another matter. While they were still climbing from the roof into an attic, they were wrapped up in the power and whisked inside. Fortunately, Cairhien and the others seemed to think they were there to steal, though the maidens might not have thought it was so fortunate. They were tossed into the street, so bruised they could hardly walk, and still struggling not to sniffle when they got back to the tents. The other wise ones took turns upbraiding Aeron and her friends, usually in private, though Cerulea appeared to make a point of confronting them before as many people as possible. Savannah and her two companions sneered quite openly whenever they saw Aeron or one of the others, and speculated among themselves in very audible voices about what the Aes Sedai would do when they found out. Even Cerulea looked at them askance for that, but no one said anything, and Aeron and her friends began walking as small as the apprentices. The apprentices began trying to hide when not actually performing their duties or taking lessons. Sharp tempers became like razors. Except for her hole, Egwene managed to avoid the worst of it, but only because she stayed away from the tents a good deal, largely to stay clear of Savannah before she taught the woman a lesson. She had no doubt how that would end. Savannah was accepted as a wise one, no matter how many grimaces there might be when she was not around. Amis and Bear would probably let the Shido woman set her punishment. At least staying away was not too difficult. She might be an apprentice, but only Cerulea made any effort to teach her the thousand things a wise one had to know. Until Amis and Bear gave her final permission to return to Tel Iron Riod, her days and nights were largely her own, so long as she managed to escape being snapped up with Saranda and the rest to wash dishes or gather dung for the fires, or the like. She could not understand why the days seemed to pass so slowly. She thought it must be waiting on Amis and Bear. Gawain was at the Longman every morning. She became used to the fat innkeeper's suggestive smirks, though once or twice she did think of kicking the woman. Maybe three times, no more than that. Those hours went by in a flash. No sooner did she sit on his knee than it was time to straighten her hair and leave. Sitting on his knee no longer frightened her. Not that it had ever frightened her exactly, but it had come to be more than pleasant. If she sometimes thought things she should not have, if those thoughts made her blush, well, he always brushed her face with his fingers when she blushed and said her name in a way she could have spent a lifetime hearing. He let slip less about what was going on with the Aes Sedai than she learned elsewhere, and she could hardly make herself care. It was the other hours that dragged out as though mired in mud. There was so little to do that she thought she might burst from frustration. Wise ones keeping watch on Arillin's mansion reported no more Aes Sedai. Chosen from those who could channel, the watchers said the Aes Sedai were still wielding the power inside day and night without break. But Egwene did not dare go close, and if she had, she could not have told what they were doing without seeing the flows. Had the wise ones been less snappish, she might have tried to spend time reading in her tent. But the one time she touched a book except at night by lamplight, Bear muttered so about girls wasting their days lying about lazily that Egwene murmured that she had forgotten something and scurried out of the tent before she was found something more useful to do. A few moments' conversation with another apprentice could be as dangerous. Stopping to talk with Saranda, who was hiding in the shade cast by a tent belonging to some stone dogs, earned her an afternoon doing laundry when Cerulea found them. She might actually have been glad of chores, just for something to do, but Cerulea examined the perfectly clean wash hung inside the tent to keep off the ever-present dust, sniffed, and told them to do it again. Twice she told them to do it again. Savannah watched part of that, too. Being in the city always made Egwene look over her shoulder, yet on the third day she picked her way down to the docks as cautiously as a mouse stealing from a cat. A wizened fellow with a narrow little boat scratched his thinning hair and demanded a silver mark to row her out to the sea folk's ship. Everything was dear, but that was ridiculous. She fixed him with a level stare, told him he could have a silver penny, still far too much, really, and hoped the bargaining would not take her whole purse. She did not have much. Everybody jumped and flinched at the Aiel, but when it came to bargaining they forgot all about Cadinsor and spears and fought like lions. He opened his toothless mouth, closed it, peered at her, then muttered under his breath, and to her surprise, told her she was stealing the bread out of his mouth. "Get in," he grumbled. "Get in. I cannot waste all day for a pittance. Brow-beating a man. Stealing the bread." He went on like that even after he began working the oars, pulling the tiny boat out onto the broad waters of the Alguenya. Egwene did not know whether Rand had met this wave mistress, but she hoped he had. According to Elaine, the dragon reborn was the sea folk Coramore, the chosen one, and all he had to do was appear to have them running at his beck and call. She hoped they did not grovel too much, though. Rand got more than enough of that already. Still, it was not Rand that sent her out with the muttering boatman. Elaine had actually met some of the Atha'an Mier, had traveled on one of their ships, and she said sea folk wind finders could channel, some of them anyway, maybe most. That was a secret the Atha'an Mi'er held close, but the wind finder on Elaine's vessel had been more than willing to share her knowledge once her secret was penetrated. Sea folk wind finder knew weather. Elaine claimed they knew more of weather than the Aes Sedai. She said the wind finder on her ship had worked enormous flows to produce favorable winds. Egwene had no idea how much of that was true and how much enthusiasm, but learning a little about weather would certainly be better than twiddling her thumbs and wondering whether being caught by Nasuna might be a relief from the Wise Ones and Savannah. With what she knew now, she could not have made it rain if the skies were black except for lightning. At the moment, of course, the sun burned golden in a cloudless sky, and heat shimmers danced over the dark water. At least the dust did not make it far onto the river. When the boatman finally drew in his oars and let the small craft drift beside the ship, Egwene stood up, ignoring his mutters that she would have them both in the river. "Hello," she called. "Hello! May I come aboard?" She had been on several riverboats and was proud that she knew the right terms. Ship folk seemed touchy about the right words, but this vessel was outside her experience. She had seen river craft longer, a few, but none so tall. Some of the crew were in the rigging or clambering up the slanted masts, dark, bare-chested men, barefoot in wide, colorful trousers held up by bright sashes, dark women in bright blouses as well. She was just at the point of shouting again, louder, when a rope ladder uncoiled down the side of the ship. No answering call came from the ship, yet that seemed invitation enough. Egwene climbed. It was difficult. Not the climb, but keeping her skirts decently close. She could see why the sea folk women wore trousers, but finally she reached the rail. Immediately her eyes fell on a woman not a span away on the deck. Her blouse and trousers were blue silk with a darker sash. She wore 3 worked gold earrings in each ear, and a fine chain that supported tiny glittering medallions ran from one to a ring in her nose. Elaine had described this, and even demonstrated using Telairun Riod, but seeing it in the flesh made Egwene wince. But there was something else. She could sense the ability to channel. She had found the wind finder. She opened her mouth, and a dark hand flashed in front of her eyes with a gleaming dagger. Before she could scream, the blade sliced through the ropes of the ladder. Still clinging to the useless thing, she plummeted. She did scream then, for all of a heartbeat, before she went into the river feet first, plunging deep. Water rushed into her open mouth, drowning her scream. She thought she swallowed half the river. Frantically, she struggled to unwrap her skirts from around her head and rid herself of the ladder. She was not in a panic. She was not. How far down had she gone? It was all muddy darkness around her. Which way was up? Iron bands gripped her chest, but she breathed out through her nose, watching the bubbles stream, as it seemed to her, down and to her left. Twisting, she stroked for the surface. How far? Lungs burning. Her head broke through into daylight and she sucked in air with a coughing gasp. To her surprise, the boatman reached down and hauled her into his boat by increments, muttering at her to stop thrashing before she upset them, adding that sea folk were a touchy lot. He leaned over again to reclaim her shawl before it sank once more. She snatched it from him and he shied back as if he thought she meant to hit him with it. Her skirts hung heavily, her blouse and shift clung. Her headscarf slanted across her forehead. A pool began to form in the bottom of the boat under her feet. The boat had drifted maybe 20 paces from the ship. The wind finder was at the railing now, and 2 more women, one in plain green silk, the other brocaded red worked with gold thread. Their earrings and nose rings and chains caught the sun. "You are refused the gift of passage," the green-clad woman called, and the one in red shouted, "Tell the other disguises do not fool us. You do not frighten us. You are all refused the gift of passage." The wizened boatman picked up his oars, but Egwene pointed a finger straight at his narrow nose. "Stop right where you are." He stopped, dunking her, not a word of common courtesy." Drawing a deep breath, she embraced Sidar and channeled four flows before the Windfinder could react. So she knew weather, did she? Could she divide her flows four ways? Not many Aes Sedai could. One flow was spirit, a shield she shoved onto the Windfinder to keep her from interfering, if she knew how. Each of the other three was air, woven almost delicately around each woman, binding her arms to her sides. Lifting them was not precisely difficult, but not easy either. A clamor rose on the ship as the women floated into the air and out over the river. Egwene heard the boatman moaning. She was not interested in him. The three seafolk women did not even kick. With an effort, she hoisted them higher, some 10 or 12 paces above the surface. No matter how hard she strained, that seemed to be the limit. "Well, you don't want to actually hurt them," she thought, and released the weaves. "They'll scream now." The seafolk women curled into balls as soon as they began to fall, spun, straightened with their arms thrust out before them. They entered the water with three quite small splashes. Moments later, three dark heads broke the surface, and the women began swimming rapidly back toward the ship. Egwene closed her mouth. "If I haul them up by their ankles and dunk their heads, they'll..." What was she thinking? They had to scream because she had? She was no wetter than they. "I must look like a drowned rat." She channeled carefully. Working about yourself always took care. You could not see the flows clearly, and water rolled off her, oozed out of her garments. It made quite a puddle. It was the boatman staring at her, mouth hanging open and eyes wide, that made her realize what she had done. Channeled, in the middle of the river, with nothing to hide her from any Aes Sedai who happened to be where she could see. Sun or no sun, she suddenly felt cold to the bone. "You may take me back to shore now." No telling who was on the docks. At this distance, she could not tell a man from a woman. "Not to the city, the riverbank." The fellow flung himself against his oars so hard she almost fell over backward. He took her to a spot where the shore was all smooth rocks the size of her head. There was no one in sight, but she leaped out as soon as the boat grated onto the rocks, hoisted her skirts, and darted up the sloping bank at a dead run she maintained all the way back to her tent, where she collapsed in a panting pile of sweat. She did not go near the city again, except to meet Gawain, of course. The days passed, and the now almost ceaseless wind carried waves of dust and grit day and night. On the fifth night, Bear accompanied Egwene into the world of dreams, just a quick jaunt in the nature of a test, a walk in the part of Tel Arunriod that Bear knew best, the Aiel Waste, a parched, jagged land that made even drought-torn Cairhien seem lush and fair. A quick trip, and then Bear and Amys came to wake her and see whether it had had any ill effect. It had not. No matter how they made her run and jump, no matter how often they peered into her eyes and listened to her heart, they agreed. But agreement or not, the next night Amys took her for another short trip to the waste, followed by another examination that made her glad to crawl onto her pallet and fall into a deep sleep. Those two nights she did not return to the world of dreams, but it was more exhaustion than anything else. Before that, she had told herself every night she should stop, a fine thing if she was caught violating their strictures just when they were ready to lift them. But somehow she always decided that just a short trip would be all right, quick enough to reduce the chance of exposure. One thing she did avoid was the place between Tel Arunriod and the waking world, the place where dreams floated. Especially she avoided it after she found herself thinking that if she was very careful, she might be able to peek into Gawain's dreams without being drawn in, and that even if she was pulled in, it would only be a dream. She reminded herself firmly that she was a grown woman, not a silly girl. She was just glad no one else knew what a snarl the man made of her thoughts. Amys and Bear would laugh till they cried. On the seventh night, she prepared herself for bed, carefully, putting on a fresh shift and brushing her hair till it shone. All useless so far as Tel Arunriod was concerned, but it kept her from thinking about how her stomach was doing backflips. Tonight it would be Aes Sedai waiting in the heart of the stone, not Nynaeve or Elaine. That should make no difference, unless... The ivory-backed hairbrush froze in mid-stroke. Unless one of the Aes Sedai revealed that she was only accepted. Why had she not thought of that before? Light, but she wished she could talk with Nynaeve and Elaine. Only she could not see what good it would do, and she was certain that dream of breaking things meant something would go badly wrong if she did speak to them. Chewing her lip, she considered going to Amice and telling her she was not feeling well. Nothing serious, just an upset stomach, but she did not think she could visit the dream tonight. They were going to start her lessons again after tonight's meeting, but... Another lie, and a coward's way to boot. She would not be a coward. Not everyone could be as brave as everyone else, but cowardice was despicable. Whatever happened tonight, she had to make herself face it, and that was that. Firmly, she put down the brush, blew out the lamp, and crawled onto her pallet. She was tired enough that falling asleep presented no problem, though if necessary she knew how to put herself to sleep at any time now, or enter a light trance where she could be in the world of dreams and still talk, well, mumble, to someone waiting by her body. The last thing before sleep came, she realized something surprising. Her stomach was not turning over anymore. She stood in a great vaulted chamber forested with thick columns of polished redstone, the heart of the stone in the Stone of Tyr. Gilded lamps hung from chains overhead, unlit, but there was, of course, light, coming from everywhere and nowhere. Amice and Bear were already there, looking no different than they had that morning, except that all their necklaces and bracelets sparkled a bit more than even gold really should have. They were talking quietly and looking irritated. Egwene caught only a word here and there, but two of them were Randall Thor. Abruptly, she realized she was wearing an accepted's white dress with the banded hem. As soon as she did, it became a copy of the Wise One's garb, without jewelry. She did not think the other two women had noticed, or would know what the dress meant if they did. There were times when surrender lost less G and earned less toe than the alternatives, but no Aiel would ever consider it without even trying to fight. "They are late again," Amice said wryly, walking out into the open space beneath the chamber's great dome. Driven into the floorstones there was what appeared to be a sword made of crystal, Kalandor of prophecy, a male Sangreal, and one of the most powerful ever made. Rand had put it there to remind the Tyrans of him, as if there was any chance of them forgetting. But Amice barely glanced at it. To others, the sword that is not a sword might be a symbol of the dragon reborn. To her, it was a Wetlander concern. "At least we can hope they will not try to pretend they know everything and we nothing. They were much better last time." Bear's snort would have made Cerulea blink. "They will never be better. The least they can do is be where they said they would be when they said that..." She cut off as seven women appeared suddenly on the other side of Kalandor. Egwene recognized them, including the young woman with the determined blue eyes she had seen before in Tel Arun Riod. Who was she? Amice and Bear had mentioned the others, usually in acid tones, but never another. She wore a blue-fringed shawl. They all wore their shawls. Their dresses changed color and cut from moment to moment, but the shawls never flickered. The Aes Sedai's eyes focused immediately on Egwene. The Wise Ones might as well not have existed. "Egwene Alvear," Shiriam said formally, "you are summoned before the Hall of the Tower." Her tilted green eyes shone with some suppressed emotion. Egwene's stomach sank. They knew she had been masquerading as a full sister. "Ask not why you are summoned," Carlinia said right behind Shiriam, her icy voice making the formality even harder. "It is yours to answer, not to question." For some reason, she had cut her dark hair short. That was the sort of unimportant detail that seemed to loom large in Egwene's mind. She certainly did not want to think about what this all meant. The ceremonious phrases rolled on in a stately rhythm. Amice and Bear adjusted their shawls and frowned, their irritation beginning to turn to concern.
"Delay not in your coming."
Egwene had always thought Anaya kindly, but the bluff-faced woman sounded as firm as Carlinia, and not all that much warmer in her formality.
"It is yours to obey in haste."
The three spoke in unison.
"It is well to fear the summons of the hall. It is well to obey in haste and humility, unasking. You are summoned to kneel before the hall of the tower and accept their judgment."
Egwene controlled her breathing, at least enough that she managed not to pant. What was the penalty for what she had done? Not light, she suspected. Not if all this ceremony went with it. They were all staring at her. She tried to read something on those Aes Sedai faces. Six showed only ageless serenity, with maybe a hint of intensity in the eyes. The young blue had the cool calmness of one who had been Aes Sedai for years, but she could not hide a slight, satisfied smile. They seemed to be waiting for something.
"I will come as soon as I can," she said.
Maybe her stomach was down in her ankles, but she could match them with her voice. No cowardice. She would be Aes Sedai, if they let her, after this.
"I don't know how quickly, though. It's a long way, and I do not know exactly where Salidar is, just somewhere along the River Eldar."
Shiryam exchanged glances with the others. Her dress went from pale blue silk to dark gray with divided skirts.
"We are sure there is a way to make the journey quickly, if the wise ones will help. Swan is sure it will require no more than a day or two if you enter Tel Iron Riad physically."
"No," Bear snapped. At the same instant, Amis said, "We will not teach her such a thing. It was used for evil, it is evil, and whoever does it loses part of themselves."
"You cannot be sure of this," Bayonin said patiently, "since it seems none of you have ever done it. But if you know of it, you must have some notion of how it is done. We may be able to work out what you do not know."
Patience was exactly the wrong tone. Ami settled her shawl and stood up even straighter than usual. Bear planted fists on hips with a glare that showed teeth. In a moment there was going to be one of those eruptions the wise ones had hinted at. They were going to teach these Aes Sedai a few lessons about what could be done in Tel Iron Riad, by way of showing them how little they knew. The Aes Sedai faced them quite calmly, full of confidence. Their shawls held steady, but their dresses flickered almost as fast as Egwene's heartbeat. Only the young blue's garb had any semblance of holding, changing just once during that long silence. She had to stop it. She had to go to Salidar, and it certainly would help nothing if she came as witness to the humiliation of these Aes Sedai.
"I know how. I think I do. I'm willing to try."
If it did not work, she could always ride. "But I still have to know where, better than I do now, anyway." Amis and Bear turned their attention from the Aes Sedai to her. Not even Carlinia could have equaled those cold stares, or Morvryn. Egwene's heart sank after her stomach. Shiryam immediately began giving directions, so many miles west of this village, so many leagues south of that, but the young blue cleared her throat and said,
"This may be more help."
The voice sounded familiar, but Egwene could not connect it to the face. Perhaps she had little better control of her clothing than the others. Soft green silk became deep blue as she spoke. A high embroidered neck became a lace ruff in the Tyran style, a cap of pearls appearing on her head. But she did know something of Tel Iron Riad. Suddenly a large map hung in the air to one side, with a glowing red dot at one end labeled Kyrian in large letters, and another as Salidar at the other. The map began to expand and change. Suddenly the mountains were not just lines, but raised up. The forests took on shades of green and brown. The rivers glittered like blue water in sunlight. It grew until it made a wall hiding the entire side of the heart. It was like looking down on the world. Even the wise ones were impressed enough to ignore their disapproval, at least until the woman's Tyran gown turned to yellow silk with a silver-embroidered neckline. The young woman was not interested in them, though.
For some reason, she stared challengingly at the other Aes Sedai. "That is splendid, Swan," Shiriam said after a moment. Egwene blinked. "Swan? It must be a woman of the same name." This younger Swan gave a self-satisfied sniff and a sharp nod very reminiscent of Swan Sanche, but that was impossible. "You're just trying to put it off," she told herself firmly. "It's certainly enough for me to find Salidar, whether or not I can..." She glanced at Amis and Bear, so full of silent disapproval they could have been carved of winter stone. "Whether or not I can come here in the flesh. One way or another, I promise I will be in Salidar as soon as I can." The map vanished. "Light! What are they going to do to me?" Her mouth half-formed the question, and Carlinia cut her off sharply, deep in the ceremony again and even harder than before. "Ask not why you are summoned. It is yours to answer, not to question." "Delay not in your coming," Anaya said. "It is yours to obey in haste." The Aes Sedai exchanged glances and vanished so quickly, she half wondered whether they thought she would ask anyway. That left her alone with Amis and Bear, but when she turned to them, uncertain whether to begin with an explanation or an apology or just a plea for understanding, they vanished too, leaving her there alone, surrounded by the redstone columns, with Kalandor glittering beside her. There were no excuses in Jito. Exhaling sadly, she stepped out of Telairun Riod back to her sleeping body. She woke immediately. Waking when you wished was as much a part of a dreamwalker's training as going to sleep when you wished, and she had promised to go as quickly as she could. Channeling, she lit the lamps, all of them. She would need light. She made an effort to be brisk as she knelt beside one of the small chests that stood against the walls of the tent and began digging out clothes she had not worn since going to the waste. A part of her life was over, but she would not cry over the loss. She would not.
As soon as Egwene disappeared, Rand stepped out from among the columns. He came here sometimes to look at Kalandor. The first visit had been after Asmodian taught him to invert his weaves. Then he had changed the traps laid around the Sangreal, so only he could see them. If the prophecies could be believed, whoever drew it out would follow after him. He was not sure how much he did believe any longer, but there was no sense taking chances. Luce Theron rumbled somewhere in the back of his head. He always did when Rand came close to Kalandor. But tonight the gleaming crystal sword interested Rand not at all. He stared at where the huge map had hung. Not really a map. There at the end, but something more. What was this place? Was it simple chance that drew him here tonight instead of yesterday or tomorrow? One of his Tavirin tugs on the pattern? No matter. Egwene had accepted that summons meekly, and that she would never do if it came from the tower and Elida. This Salidar was where her mysterious friends were hiding, where Elaine was. They had handed themselves to him. Laughing, he opened a gateway to the reflection of the palace in Camelon.